Welcome to Your Turn. My name's Renee Giacchino. I'm Corporate Counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. To learn more about my organization, please visit our website at www.cfif.org. Well, we are taping right now at the CPAC conference up here in Washington, D.C. We've got a wonderful lineup of guests joining us on the program over the next 2 days. In fact, we just heard some interesting news upstairs. Mitt Romney has decided to, I guess you don't call it drop out of the race, but rather defund his campaign. He gets to keep his delegates, keep his spot, but he is defunding his campaign. So we are bringing that to you right hot from the floor here at the CPAC conference. Joining me as my first guest this afternoon is Dr. John Felmy. He is a chief economist with the American Petroleum Institute, and he's coming on to help us sort out some of the issues related to energy and help us better understand what they should be talking about on the campaign trail as it relates to energy. Dr. Felmy, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a little bit about your organization. Tell us about the organization and your mission.
Well, API is an organization that's been around since 1919. We represent all aspects of the petroleum industry, exploration, production, refining, marketing, basically well to your service station. We do a whole host of things such as statistics, we do policy analysis, we also have training programs, quality programs, standards, for example, so that pipes fit together around the world. And we do advocacy for the Institute in terms of what the industry thinks is the appropriate policy to pursue.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that last issue then. Give me a snapshot, if you will, please, of the policy issues that they are talking about, and then I want to get to the policy issues that they are not yet necessarily talking about, but they should be talking about on the campaign trail.
Well, unfortunately, right now, it appears as though most of the discussion is along the following. How do we tax the oil industry and spend it on alternatives? How do we try to change our policies in that direction? There's also a lot of unfortunate discussions about supposedly they want to take subsidies away from the industry, when in fact that's not real. All the discussion we had, for example, in the energy bill that they had last year was trying to single out the industry for provisions in the tax code that were passed for all industries. So what they're being characterized is, oh, this is an industry that's being unfairly subsidized and it really doesn't need it. So what we're trying to do is set the record straight. These are the facts in terms of what the industry is doing, what we think should happen with energy policy. And in that vein, as you mentioned, we think that there should be an energy policy that, first of all, supports additional supplies of all energy, oil, coal, gas, nuclear, hydro, and renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, and so on. We need a policy that also improves energy efficiency. And encourages people to wisely use energy. And finally, in order to be able to get that energy to consumers, you're going to need more infrastructure. You're going to need more power lines, more refineries, more pipelines, and so on. And unfortunately, the policies that have been put in place really don't do most of that. So what we're trying to say is these are the facts on energy, and this is what you should do.
Have we got any of the candidates who have sought more information either from API or any of the other organizations? It doesn't seem, I mean, certainly folks are talking a lot about the economy. They're talking a lot about the war in Iraq. Energy, I mean, in as much as obviously the economy impacts the family day to day, I think a lot of folks would be surprised to realize that truly energy is probably the number one issue that impacts us on a daily basis, both in our pocketbooks, in our homes, in our workplaces, in our schools. Everywhere you go, the issue of energy should be something we're talking about. Any of the candidates starting to focus in on that issue, do you think?
Well, I think it's still too soon in the campaign. In past campaigns, we've seen that once you have the front runner established and you have the nominee, then they start to flesh out their programs across the board. And so we're committed as an institute to brief any of the candidates on what the facts on energy are, what we think will be helpful to their constituents and consumers. And so we're looking forward to doing that through the rest of the year.
We are based outside of the panhandle of Florida and obviously right there on the beautiful Gulf of Mexico. And drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico is an issue that certainly the folks listening to this station always perk up when we talk about it. Has API taken a position on drilling for oil in the Gulf? And if so, what would be that position? And if you haven't formally taken a position, can you give us your thoughts on, you know, what is the information out there? What are the facts and what are the myths that people are hearing about drilling for oil in the Gulf?
Well, API believes that we should explore for oil and natural gas in an environmentally responsible way in public lands. So, for example, the eastern Gulf of Mexico is largely uncharted area in terms of having restrictions on drilling and so on. Look, we think we can demonstrate how successful the industry is in terms of both producing oil in an environmentally responsible manner. If you look at the impact that the industry took in terms of Katrina and Rita, the industry suffered, 200-mile-an-hour winds, 100-foot seas, and had no significant spills from the wells. So we think that that's really demonstrated what we can do. And, you know, what I would think is, give us a chance. We think that, one, it'll generate jobs, it'll help our trade situation, and that it will help consumers in terms of adding additional supplies. But unfortunately, folks remember, some of the ancient technology, such as what happened in Santa Barbara, or, the Valdez Institute, which had Valdez incident, which had nothing to do with oil production. So we think we need to open this debate, but right now it's just a situation where the East Coast, the West Coast, the Eastern Gulf, the Intermountain West and parts of Alaska are off limits.
Did API take a position on the case before the Supreme Court in that involved Exxon Valdez and that situation? Do you know if API took a position? Did they file an amicus brief in that case? I know you're the chief economist, and I'm kind of taking you out of your bailiwick, but...
I'm an economist, and so a man's got to know his limitations.
There you go.
I'm not sure exactly what our position was on that.
Well, we can check that out. I know that was a very critical case, particularly for folks who were following it, even from a legal reform standpoint, which is something we like to talk a lot about on this program. Let me move to CAFE standards. I assume that that is something that API at least takes a position on, and if you take that position, how closely do you work with, and do you have member companies who are the automobile producers and follow, obviously, this issue a lot closer?
Well, we do not have a position on CAFE standards. The reason being is that we don't make autos, and we don't have any members who make autos.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
But we do feel strongly that we need to improve the efficiency of vehicles. We need to improve the efficiency of any types of motors, of housing, of hotels, of buildings. An important part of energy policy is improving energy efficiency, but we don't have a position on fuel economy standards.
How are we doing as a nation in terms of alternative fuel sources? I mean, are we lagging behind other nations? Are we technologically advancing ourselves enough to hopefully have in place some of these renewable sources that folks are talking about? And, I'm really struggling myself about the issue of, these hybrid cars. And do we have enough resources available? Should there be, the surge that they're hoping will happen with those types of vehicles? Corn production, and how could that impact us economically as a nation?
Well, I think it's helpful to understand really where we get our energy in a broad sense first. We get about 40% of our energy from petroleum, 23% natural gas, 23% coal, 8% nuclear, and then what you call renewables, about 6%. Of that 6, half, 3% is hydro. And nobody's advocating building any more big dams. Another percent and a half or so is wood and wood waste and biomass, primarily in the pulp and paper industry. And so if you look at what people call renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal, ethanol, it's less than 2% of our total energy supplies. So one has to be very realistic that while we're going to need that supply, we're going to need more of all types of energy, you've got to be realistic about how much you actually can get online because of the technology and the cost. Ethanol has grown. There's a mandate that it's going to go from over 6 billion gallons last year to 9 this year. And that's going to be quite a challenge in terms of both producing it along with shipping it and getting it to consumers. So we've got to be realistic about where our energy comes from and how we actually use it, because our position is we're going to need everything. So we're going to need advanced energy. And the oil companies, for example, are investing in these new technologies. But at the same time, you got to keep the gasoline pumps running 24/7. You got to keep the lights on. And so, we're going to need it all, but you can't leave people in the dark.
All right, we are talking with Dr. John Felmy. He's a chief economist with the American Petroleum Institute, API. Would you help us, walk us through from start to finish almost, how gas prices are set. I know a lot of folks still scratch their heads. They don't understand how it is that, you know, if something happens overseas, you know, there's an event overseas and all of a sudden we see a spike in oil prices, you know, and that almost seems to happen overnight. But then maybe when things calm down, it takes a lot longer for those prices to come back down. Now, I know a lot of it has to do with the reserves, at least that's what I've been told, but help us get a better understanding when we see these peaks and we haven't seen too many of the lows, but when we see the spiking going on, how is that all determined?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the market for gasoline is really no different than the market for any other good. But everybody knows the price of gasoline, but I'll bet if you ask your listeners what's the price of anything else they buy...
Other than a gallon of milk.
Don't.
We've been
watching
that.
You know, not even everybody knows that. I mean, I occasionally follow it because I look at it in Costco, but, you know, not everybody would know what that is. In fact, you could probably ask 10 people along here and we'd see what they get if they get it right.
That'd be a good question.
The key thing is you first of all start with the worldwide market for crude oil. And that's a world market. We've got supply and demand conditions that set the price. Crude oil is traded on markets like the New York Mercantile Exchange, and the prices are set by suppliers and demanders around the globe. Why is the price of crude oil reached $100 a barrel? Well, that's because you've seen strong demand worldwide from like China, India, other developing countries. You've also had supply challenges, for example, Nigeria, Iraq, Venezuela. So the demand is up and supply is down, and as a simple supply and demand, that's why prices go up. So when it also might help your listeners that there's 42 gallons in a barrel. That's a very important number. So when you hear crude oil is $100 a barrel, it works out to $2.38 a gallon. So if you say at $100, it's $2.38, well, and here in the United States, the average of taxes is 47 cents. So you add $2.38 and 47, and you've got over $2.80 is the cost before you refine, marketed, transported, or deliver it. So the first thing is, you know, what's your cost and taxes? And then you've got supply and demand factors at the wholesale level, the retail level, and so on that affect the margins. So, for example, recently, demand for gasoline has been down, so the supply chain has really been squeezed. For example, some refiners lost money last quarter, so you saw that so that you couldn't pass along your costs. And then you look at diesel, it's the same situation. So it's really the markets for crude oil and then the markets for the refined products that ultimately determine the price. At the local level, you see a lot of differences in prices. Most of it is due to taxes, for example, because taxes vary quite a bit across states. You also have state, you have local taxes, and you have different types of gasoline. So, for example, in Florida, you've got several different areas that have different types of gasoline than, say, what you have on a panhandle. So there's cost issues that come into play. In the case of diesel, we just changed to an ultra-low sulfur diesel, and that's much more expensive to produce. Now, in terms of your question about, you know, how prices move, what we've seen over the past years is because everything is so electronically connected, the wholesaler who probably didn't know years ago what was happening on the world markets for crude oil, he knows what's happening for the world markets of crude oil. He knows what's happening on the futures market for gasoline in New York, and he knows what the wholesale markets. And so you have information is transmitted very, very quickly, and people, you know, respond
react
to those
to
markets.
It.
That's
sure.
Right. At the local level, people often ask, well, gee, that gas station owner, and, you know, one thing that also helps is to know that even though there may be, say, an Exxon flag out there, that station is probably owned by a local businessman. 90% of the stations are owned by small businessmen
franchises,
you know, and they're not by the major companies. When he looks and sees prices go up dramatically, as say they did in Katrina and so on, he thinks, well, gee, the next time I fill up that tank, it's going to cost me a lot more. So he responds to the market price rather than his cost because it's a cash flow problem.
Okay. Well, that helps us understand a little bit better. For folks who want to learn more about your organization and maybe try and sort some of these issues out themselves, where can they go?
Well, they can go to www.api.org, American Petroleum Institute, so api.org, or another website we have called energytomorrow.org. It's all together, energytomorrow.org or api.org. And there's a whole host of facts and figures and positions on that, and I'd encourage people to look at it.
We're having a real push in Florida, and I think nationwide, to educate our students better in math and science. What do you think the challenges are going to be for the next generation when we talk about energy issues?
boy, that is the biggest challenge we face. It's called, you know, the big crew change. If you look across our energy industries, and I can speak for petroleum, 50% of our employees can retire within 10 years.
Wow.
Now, that's both a challenge, but it's also a wonderful opportunity for young people. I love going to college campuses with our technology displays and say, you know, first of all, we're an exciting industry. We're not what people characterize it. You know, we drill in 2 miles of water. We've got more computer processing than anybody but the Defense Department. So these are exciting jobs. We're not going away because oil and natural gas are going to be around for decades. You know, we'll have new sources come online, but, you know, you've got a fixed amount that you have to be able to responsibly deliver for the years. So we're not going away, and they're good jobs. They're well-paying. You know, a petroleum engineer could make close to $70,000 to start. And with everybody else retiring, you're going to move up in the organization very quickly. So we really hope people will look at the oil industry and the energy industry in general.
That generation obviously is very embroiled in technology. How is technology advancing the petroleum industry?
Boy, it's incredible. If you look at, for example, how much we can now find in terms of oil and gas, it's incredible. We just can drill now in 2 miles of water. Well, it's because we've had seismic technology that allows us to be able to look below the salt layer and find it. And so you had, for example, the Jack oil field that was discovered could be 10 billion barrels that we couldn't have done it with the technology. We've got computer processing technology. We've got a smaller footprint. So technology really drives our industry.
And I assume you need folks who have an interest not just in engineers, but also weather-related people. I assume you have to be following those issues as well. Out there, certainly if you're drilling in the Gulf and other places.
We need engineers, we need scientists, we need geophysicists, we even need economists. So, you know, I think it's a wonderful opportunity. It's a good organizations we can that people should consider.
All right, let me go back one more question on the economy as the chief economist. Right now, obviously, there's a lot going on with this idea of a stimulus package. There are some folks who believe, can't we just get that money instead of one lump sum, get that money back, you know, from the government? Can they just help us out day to day? And obviously, we look first to one of the things that we spend a lot of money on average, and that is filling up our cars. Has API taken a position on the stimulus package, and has there been any discussion whatsoever of, you know, can we work in getting, and I know you all don't set the tax prices on gas, but I mean, you made a very good point of saying on average 47 cents of what we pay in every gallon of gas goes right to taxes. Doesn't it make a little more sense maybe if we want to stimulate the economy to give the folks that money back in their pockets every day rather than just one lump sum?
Well, you know, there are potential problems with that. If you were to reduce the taxes, what you do is you reduce the price potential. That can increase demand and make the market tighter. So there is that potential unintended consequence. What we really think the government should do is enact energy policies that increase supplies of petroleum and other products, reduce demand, and improve the infrastructure. And that will have a way of working its way through the economy, helping consumers, and in turn, you know, stimulating the whole economy as we go forward. The last thing, however, I would argue that we shouldn't do is repeat the mistakes of the past. We have had discussions of price gouging and other things like that, which is nothing more than price controls that we had in the 70s that caused gas lines. So let's not repeat that mistake. Getting money out to consumers can help the economy, and that's the decision the government has to face.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Dr. John Felmy. He's chief economist with API. To learn more about their organization, please visit them on the web at www.api.org.